You are listening to a sermon by Julie Canlis, recording on Sunday, September 17, 2023, at Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speakers are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcasted, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Okay, I'm about to share my screen, but before I do, I just want to say something about my two books. The second one that I wrote, Theology of the Ordinary, is much shorter, and it's kind of a spirituality of the other one. So that's the one that I would always say, start with that one. It's short. I find a lot of people love it so much that they buy 10 of them and give them away because I'm trying to approach everyday life in a Trinitarian perspective and having people understand how all of life is ensconced in what the Father, Son, and Spirit are already doing. So that's why I called it a Theology of the Ordinary. You would definitely find the influences of Eugene Peterson. You know, his fingerprints are all over it as one of my professors at Regent. But they're actually, so we publish them here and they support our nonprofit. I should tell you guys for 2 seconds about our nonprofit. You can go online and you can watch a little 30-minute free documentary that my husband and I made about our decade of living in Scotland and of doing ministry in a tiny village for 300 people. So it's called livegodspeed, I think, .org. I don't think it's .com, but it might be. I always get it confused. But that's a free documentary. On that website, you can order the book and it supports our nonprofit. But it's terrible. Shipping to Canada is just awful. So I do know that the Regent Bookstore often has, you know, 20 copies and you can, it's just cheaper shipping for those of you just up over the border. So that's all I'll say. Okay, enough with books and now into the sermon. And I'm going to press play on my keynote and I'm gonna press screen share and I think that's how I do it. Okay, here goes. Okay. Can you see as a full screen my Hebrews 8 with Aaron the priest? Okay, great. That's what I needed to know. Okay, here we are, Hebrews 8. Last week we just looked at what priesthood was and the role of priests and what it means that Jesus is our high priest. And we kind of did that from a big scale of looking at other religions and also the role of priests in Hebrew religion and Jesus as our great high priest. And now we're just going on to that little next phrase. What does it mean that Jesus sat down? We'll actually look through all of Hebrews 8 today, but that's what I really want to cover. Because priests, if you look in this picture, well, let me read you the first few verses. Here we go. Now, the main point of what we are saying is this. We do have such a high priest who sat down. Oops, let me go back. There. We do have such a high priest who sat down at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven and who serves in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle set up by the Lord, not by a mere human being. So what does it mean that this priest sat down? Because if you remember from this photo, priests don't, in Israelite religion, they're always standing. They're always standing before the throne. So what is it that our priest has sat down? Well, this is just a quick reminder that even though Christianity is listed as one of the great religions of the world, we might even be meeting because we think it's, for at least for us, the one that meets our spiritual needs the most and maybe has the most clear window on the Father's heart. But what's interesting is that Hebrews is saying that Jesus has come to end religion as they knew it, that religion is finished and that we don't need it anymore. And that he is the final temple. He's the final priest. He's the final sacrifice. This is the big overarching theme of Hebrews. He's the final rest. Interestingly, nowhere in the Bible is the word religion applied to Christianity. And this is why the Romans persecuted Christians. Romans let everyone have their own religion. Every street corner had its own temple. But Christians were persecuted for something that the Romans knew, but that we've forgotten, which is that Jesus ended religion. That's why Christians were persecuted, because they didn't have a temple. They didn't have, you know, they didn't have a religion. And so they were seen as quite suspicious. So it was the anti-religion. Christians were often killed for being atheists. So if Jesus has come to end religion, let's talk about what that really means. How? And that's what this chapter 8 of Hebrews is covering. So first we need to sort out a few things. Here it says, Jesus serves in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle, set up by the Lord, not by a mere human being. So what is this true tabernacle that we're talking about? Now that he's serving in the true tabernacle, what is the true tabernacle? Well, you'll remember this verse. The word became flesh and tabernacled among us. Okay, so if his body is the true tabernacle, if he is serving now in his body, he's now serving for us in his body is the true tabernacle, where is this tabernacle now? I love this picture by Dolly. It's very provocative just in that, you know, you want to touch his toes, but the whole point is Jesus has risen with his body, with the tabernacle where he's serving now all the time, to the right hand of the Father, and he is seated there. This is what it means that our priest has sat down. He is seated at the right hand of the Father, and he's serving not in a tabernacle made of skins, not in a temple, but he is serving now in his own body. So the next question is, what does that mean? So let's look at what Hebrews 8 will lead us through. Those priests serve at a sanctuary that is a copy and a shadow of what is in heaven. But the priestly ministry Jesus does is superior to theirs, just as the covenant Jesus brings is superior to the old one. For if there had been nothing wrong with the first covenant, no place would have been sought for a new one. So the questions we're trying to answer, and we've answered, what's the true tabernacle and where is it? And it's a copy of what? And if he's serving in this true tabernacle, what does this mean? Why is he seated? Well, we've just discovered that all wood and stone temples are just poor imitations of his human fleshly body. All temples were just looking forward to the day when the real temple would show up. And what is he doing in this temple as high priest at the right hand of the Father? He's doing the new covenant. He is loving his Father. That's why Hebrews 8 rolls on with Jeremiah, which I'm about to go over for you. But he's seated because he is the new tabernacle, and in his body, he's now enacting the new covenant. He is loving his Father. He is the new covenant in person. And he is a human being in love with God and God in love with human beings. He is what religion has always hoped to achieve. So if that's what he's doing there, is there anything important to the part that he's actually sat down? Yes. Hebrews 7, if we just look back the previous chapter, Hebrews 7 talks about Jesus's new ministry in his body. And this is what it says. Therefore, he's able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. So what's he doing? He's interceding for us. He is the covenant in human form, for us and with us and in us. He's done with religious contracts. And now we are in the era of a covenant. And so the question is, what does it mean that we're in the era of the covenant? Let's look at Jeremiah. But in fact, the ministry, we're still in Hebrews 8, 6, but in fact, the ministry Jesus has received is as superior to theirs as the covenant of which he is mediator is superior to the old one, since the new covenant is established on better promises. And then Hebrews decides to not phrase Jeremiah. He actually imports all 15 verses of Jeremiah and just plunks them in there. He says, you guys know this stuff. This is, you know, this has been here all along. So here we go, straight into Jeremiah. The days are coming, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant, though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will establish with the people of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their heart. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, you should know the Lord, because they will all know me, from the least to the greatest. I will forgive their wickedness, and I will remember their sins no more. So what Hebrews is trying to say is, when Jesus sits down, we have a new covenant. And it's getting rid of the old covenant. This is superior to the old covenant, because the old covenant tended to descend into more contractual language. And we humans love to latch onto contractual language because we can be in control when we've got a contract. We know what we can do with our side of the bargain. And so this is, I just want to explore for a minute or two the difference between a covenant and a contract. So if Jesus is coming not to give us a new religion, but to end it, and instead to give us a new covenant relationship with God, what does that mean for us? Well, I would just suggest that religion says things like, if you live like this, God will accept you. The gospel reverses that. God has accepted you. Now live like this. And this is the opposite of all religion. Everything, when we walk into a church building, for example, as the liturgical director at Trinity, I'm always trying to point out to people who come to church, look, everything in the message, everything in the architecture of the building, everything in the structure of the service, everything in the way that we walk through the prayers is part of this message of the new covenant. You are freely given bread and wine. You are proclaimed from the start. You are forgiven. And then you're given liturgical actions to do with your body to convince yourself that you are not in a contractual relationship, because it's really hard for us to know that at a deep level. So we have to keep being reminded, because everything in us wants to secure our religious standing. And so what is a covenant? Let's look back at this. It's the I will. I will, says God. I will, I will, I will, I will, I will, I will, I will do this. So a covenant is an agreement. It's an intimately binding agreement between two people, which says, this is who I am and how I am going to act towards you. Notice it's not a contract. It's not saying, if you do this, then I'm obligated to do this for you. Can you imagine a love relationship that's based on, I'll be here for you as long as you do this, 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 and this? There could be no true intimacy there, because you can't have intimacy without giving some of your autonomy up, without committing and binding yourself to another person. So in a sense, marriage covenants are saying, I'm going to be this kind of person for you, regardless of the circumstances, poverty, death, suffering, or worse than all those things, your very annoying habits. I am covenanting to be this kind of person for you that you need and desire in life. And nothing is going to change that. Even if you're failing to be what you should be, I will be this kind of person in the relationship. That's a covenant. But a contract says, if you are strong enough, if you are brave enough, if you are kind enough, if you are morally strong-willed enough, lucky enough to hold up your side of the bargain, then I will fulfill these obligations towards you. And just side note, this is probably what you'd pick up from my book on Calvin. There's a whole brand of Reformed theology that gets this so badly wrong. I don't want to spend my time on it, but I'll just give you the 2-second version, which you've probably heard at some point in your life. They label the Garden of Eden as a covenant of works. But basically, that a covenant of works is not a covenant. It's basically a sneaky way of calling it a contract. And if you begin to see, because it is an oxymoron to have a covenant of works. And if you begin to see Eden as a contract, then everything is going to flow from that and infect all of Scripture with this contractual message. The whole view of God will be distorted. Everything flows from Genesis 1, whether you believe God is in contract with you or covenant with you. And then this is going to lead to a theology of God, a theology of salvation. You're going to fail at this. And then Jesus is going to come in and fulfill the failure for you. And that's going to be called salvation. But through the whole thing, you will have actually infected theology, because your very opening idea of God as a God of contracts, not covenants, will distort how we read salvation, how we read love. If you want to know a little bit more about this, I love this kind of introductory book on it. Oh, sorry. Here's a little bit of how from the 16th century onwards, this branch of Reformed theology is kind of talked about works and grace. But a book that I think really helps walk you through an alternative way of reading Genesis, and this is much more in line with the patristic fathers, is James Torrance's Worship, Community, and the Triune God of Grace. So if you want to go into that, if you want to look a little bit more into that, you can also read this book, which I highly recommend. But let's look again at this superior covenant of Jesus. I will, I will, I will. Covenants are relational, and they are based on the faithfulness of the person making the covenant, not on the recipient. That's the difference between a covenant and a contract. A covenant says, I will do this. I will fulfill this. I will be committed to you, and you cannot change this in me. And God himself has said, I'm going to be faithful to you, even if you won't be faithful to me. So Jesus, as we've seen in his life, death, and resurrection, Jesus has bound himself to us in becoming human. He has nailed himself to us in his death. The eye for an eye, tit for a tat, quid pro quo is over. Jesus says, even if you sin, I will never turn my face away from you. But a contract overturns the gospel by making God a judge first and then a father only second. In a contract, God is first and foremost a judge of humanity. He judges us according to our works, and then we must perform them rightly to stay in his good graces. And so this means our relationship to God is first one of law, conditions, and works. And then Jesus comes in later as kind of God's second idea, which is grace, communion, and intimacy. But I want to argue that it's been grace, communion, and intimacy from the start. And that's what Hebrews is trying to say in Hebrews 8. But here's something even crazier. This is why Jesus had to sit down in his new tabernacle, flesh, because he's representing all of us humans. Part of the contract, as we've seen, is God saying, I will, I will, I will, I will fulfill all my ends of the contract. Of the covenant. I will fulfill all these ends of the covenant. But here's the other radical part of Jesus's new covenant. He also fulfills ours. God wants to be our father. And he has sent us the Son to show us how to be his kids. And God says, I know you can't uphold your covenantal response to me. So even there, I'm going to let Jesus be the new Adam and stand in for you. I will, I will, I will, I will do this. And this is what it means that our priest sat down, that he's finished the whole system. He's brought it into the realm where it's always been heading through the Old Testament. The covenantal relationship. He is the fulfillment of Jeremiah. Jesus is our covenantal response to God. Okay, final minute is just to say it gets even better than this, which is that this is not a past reality. This is actually an ongoing dynamic on Jesus's part. This wasn't just the cross and resurrection. But this is what he is doing right now, because as it says in Romans 9, he ever lives to make intercession for us. So Hebrews 7, therefore he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. This isn't Jesus on his knees begging God, you know, to avert his wrath from us. No, no, no. This is Jesus constantly holding up the covenantal love of the Father on behalf of all of humanity. You have Romans 8 telling us this again. Jesus Christ is at the right hand of God and is also interceding for us. Who then shall separate us from the love of God? Neither life nor depth, neither height nor depth. And then also Romans 8, for we do not know how to pray, but the very Spirit intercedes for us with sighs too deep for words. So all of our prayers are caught up in Jesus's intercession and the Spirit's intercession for us. We don't even have to respond to God all alone by ourselves. We get to share in Jesus's worship, in the Spirit's response, in Jesus's life right now. So this is the opposite. Do you see how this is the opposite of a contract? God is saying, I will fulfill both ends of the covenant for you, and you get to participate. You get to join in this Trinitarian dynamic where I'm incorporating all of your life and I am offering it back to the Father. And so now his work as a priest for us is no longer standing and sacrificing, but it's living for us, seated. He's praying with us and in us. He is at the right hand of the Father, still in human flesh, carrying all humanity in his heart and keeping us in the loving presence of the Father. That's what it means that Jesus is our high priest. I'm just going to close with one more quote from C.S. Lewis, because Lewis says it better than everybody. He understood this basic dynamic at the heart of the universe that's now been opened up to us. And so he uses this image of an ordinary man saying his prayers. And he even takes our ordinary little prayers that we say to God, and he shows us how these are incorporated in our Trinitarian ordinary lives. He says, an ordinary, simple Christian kneels down to say his prayers. He's trying to get in touch with God. But if he is a Christian, he also knows that what is prompting him to pray is also God. God, so to speak, inside him. But he also knows that all his real knowledge of God comes through Christ, the man who was God, and that Christ is standing beside him, helping him to pray, praying for him. So do you see what is happening? God is the thing to which he is praying, the goal he is trying to reach. But God is also the thing inside of him, the motive power which is pushing him on. And God is also the road or the bridge along which he is being pushed to that very goal, so that the whole threefold life of the three personal being is actually going on in that ordinary little bedroom where an ordinary man is saying his prayers. So that's Hebrews 8, jumping frantically all through Hebrews 8 and Jeremiah. But I just wanted to give you that that sense of what we are doing, even right now, as we are taking part in this service together, is a Trinitarian approach to the Father, who is already called us, already moving us towards him. It's not a contract. It's a covenant where he is scooping us up and bringing us to himself. Amen.